Thanks for coming to today's QCES talk, and also thanks for noting the change in time. Unfortunately, we might have to get out a bit earlier, but we'll arrange that. Today's QCES talk is by Dr. Jean Calfar, who's college senior lecturer in the Department of French and fellow of Trinity College. He specializes in the history of philosophy, contemporary literature from North Africa and the Caribbean, aesthetics and anthropology. He has edited and authored works on painting and poetry, Gilles Deleuze, Frantz Fanon, as well as directed the new Routledge tradition of Foucault's History of Madness. He has written extensively on other philosophers, such as Pascal, Rousseau, Sartre, Cavaille, and Humbert, published extensively on the ethnomusicology of Central Africa with Sima Aron, and is currently working on several projects, the book on Francophone thought and poetry, one of the relationship between text and image in 20th century Livre d'Artiste, the collected writings of psychiatry of Frantz Fanon with Robert Young, and studies in Deleuze and Foucault's reflections on the autonomy of philosophy. He's also one of the editors of Wasafiri and of Le Temps Moderne. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. So, Fanon, a social construction of the body. I assume you don't all speak French, so I've reproduced a number of quotes that I'm going to refer to, both in English and in French, and they're all in a pile over there. It's quite important to have the French because one of the main books that I refer to, Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, has been very badly translated for interesting historical reasons, largely in the wake of the development of the Black Panther movement in the US, so most people have this early edition, which has interesting mistakes, so to speak, but it's, if you want to understand Fanon, it's better to look at the French or to look at the more recent edition that came out 2 or 3 years ago. So at least these translations are accurate. So Fanon was born in 1925 in Martinique in the Caribbean, French Caribbean, which is an important aspect of to understand his thought. And he died in 1961, aged only 36 from leukemia. By then, he had quite an extraordinary compact life. By then, he had taken part in the Second World War, where he won a Croix de Guerre, a very high distinction, in the Free French Forces, aged 19, I think. Then took part in the Algerian War of Independence, of course, which is well known. Played an important part in the transformation of the international anti-colonial movement, which moved importantly and partly under his influence from the non-violent resistance, which was symbolized by Gandhi in India and Nkrumah in Ghana, two countries which reached independence in a reasonably peaceful manner, so to speak, to a position of armed resistance, symbolized by the Vietnamese War, which started against the French in Indochina, and then by the Algerian War. So he theorized anti-colonial violence also, and is well known for that. During that time, he wrote 4 books. One was published posthumously, immediately after his death. And importantly, throughout this time, he continued his own personal practice as a psychiatrist. He was trained as a psychiatrist and practiced psychiatry everywhere, in fact, in France, in Algeria, and then in exile in Tunisia. He had a posting in the main hospital in Tunis. And he played a significant role in the movements of transformation of psychiatry, which took place in the 50s and 60s in Europe and also in North Africa. There were some large psychiatric asylums in Algeria and in Tunisia, which had been designed, in fact, as models against so-called backward conception of mental illness. So these were quite advanced institutions. So I think that all these aspects, resistance, anti-colonialism, resistance in the Free French Forces during the war, which was not easy coming from Martinique to get to France. He took part in the Southern Landing. So resistance, anti-colonialism, psychiatry, reflection on revolutionary violence. I think that all these things are linked to a reflection on how the individual reacts to the social construction of his or her own body at a moment of history and in a specific place. And this is what I will focus on today. I think that's really quite an important aspect of Fanon's thought, and you cannot read him without being aware of that. And in particular, I'll focus on one important thread in his thought, both on history and on the mind or on consciousness, and that's phenomenology. In particular, the phenomenology of Merleau-Ponty, whom Fanon read, and in fact whom he knew because he studied in Lyon at the time when Merleau-Ponty was lecturing. And the aim of Merleau-Ponty's brand of phenomenology was precisely to develop what he called a philosophy of the body. And in a nutshell, for Fanon, understanding the possibility of this particular stance in existence, which we call a stance of freedom, requires understanding the role for consciousness of the human body in its essential relationship to society and, in his case, in addition, to history. And that's largely the object of his first book, Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, Black Skin, White Masks, which was published in 1952. And this is, in fact, I think, in many ways, what makes him an important thinker, one who remains and who stands well above the mass of anti-colonial writings of the period, large mass of them, most of which have pretty much disappeared, even though this aspect of his thought has not been very much or perhaps very well commented on so far. So I think, and I've argued, that all his books could be read in relationship to this question of a social determination of the body, and that it would be wrong to isolate either the purely anti-colonial writings or the psycho-phenomenological works, and that's really what I will focus on today. So I start with, in fact, the last sentence of this book, this remarkable study of the, which is a remarkable study of the alienation of the métis, the mixed race, man in particular, in Martinique, Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, Black Skin, White Mask. It's important to remember the context of Martinique, which is a society where métissage has an essential dimension in the life of everyone, in the consciousness of everyone. And this last sentence by Fanon in Peau Noire, Masque Blanc is bizarrely a prayer, bizarrely for him, a prayer, and this is what it says: "My final prayer, O my body, make me always a man who questions. Fais de moi toujours un homme qui interroge." Why bizarre? First, because of this, it sounds strange in French, because of the position of this toujours. Fais de moi toujours un homme qui interroge. Always, he says, Fanon does not simply wish to be a perpetual questioner. He would have written, fais de moi un homme qui interroge toujours. Make of me a man who always questions. And this would have been a banality, in particular in the intellectual context of his time, marked by the thought of Sartre, where a human being was defined as a consciousness which stands at a distance from what there is, and in its very being constantly asks the question, why? And even more importantly, in fact, for Sartre, why not? Sartre had already opposed nothingness to being in his famous work, or the for itself to the in itself. There was no point adding to that. No, here the main focus is really on the body. What he insists on is that it is his body which should always make him a man who questions. Fais de moi toujours un homme qui interroge. But why should the questioning stance be a prerogative of the body and not the mind? And how can there be a risk, a danger, that this body might not be up to it to maintain this questioning stance if the body is simply what it is and nothing else, a material being? In addition, it's a paradoxical prayer, of course, since it's not addressed to a transcendent being, but forms rather a sort of inner dialogue with the immanence of the body, perhaps a performative dialogue where the self constitutes itself as a self in his own relationship, its own relationship to the body. And questioning the evidence of your body, which is so familiar, which is so clearly there as a thing in the world, asking something from it which is essential to yourself while doubting it, putting it into question, isn't that a form of a sort of pathology, a form of insanity? And there was, of course, for Fanon, a pathology of the relationship to the body, which was behind a lot of the cases that he had to deal with as a psychiatrist, because he dealt with a lot of people who had been subjected to torture or who inflicted torture, sometimes the same day, he says, and also because that was one of the main objects of inquiry that he worked on during his formative years. So there's a lot in this sentence, in this prayer, and it seems, by the way, that it disturbed his family after his death. That's, in fact, what drew my attention to it, because even though he's buried in Algeria and the Algerians have never wanted to release or rather send back his body against the family's request, there is a commemorative plate in the cemetery in Fort-de-France, the capital of Martinique. And there they've removed, where you find this sentence, except that they've removed all my body. So what you have is, my final prayer, make me always a man who questions. So clearly, there was an unease with this prayer addressed to the body, but of course it's a sign perhaps that a black body was not there, something that could be praised in Martinique at the time. Now, to understand this famous text, you also have to realize that what Fanon did in this long reflection on the body, which is his first book, Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, was to look for the foundation of an ethics. In the middle of the century, or the 20th century, it seemed clear that ethics could no longer be grounded on transcendent values within the French intellectual context of the time. During the battle of the Second World War, he fought, was wounded, he said in his correspondence, for universalist humanist values, freedom, human rights, etc., which in the end seemed to him retrospectively at the end of the war as having been the instruments of a manipulation, he says. He discovered in one go at the end of the war and during the final battles the reality of collaboration, a major theme of the period, in the end liberating people who perhaps didn't want to be liberated so much. Racism certainly everywhere, at home initially, and then in Algeria, where he was posted on his way to land to France, where he was trained in the Free French Forces, and where he witnessed famine and oppression. So he went to Algeria much before the Algerian War. And this, not only this discrimination, etc., not only on the part of the collaborationists, the Pétainists, but also within the Free French Forces. So his youthful and naive humanist beliefs were shattered, he says, and it seems that he found only in this particular negation of the human body, which racism is, the only possible basis against which a moral evaluation or an ethics was possible. And he was very aware of this ethical dimension of his work. You will find several quotes in this handout that show it, but I don't really have the time to go into that for my purpose. It's enough to note that for him, ethics had to be grounded not on universally accepted values, but on the act of a resistance or a fight born from the recognition of a risk to corporeal existence that racism produced. Why is that so? So have a look at the number three on this handout, the famous moment of the discovery and the understanding of what racism effectively does from inside. It starts with a quote, "Dirty nigger," or simply, "Look, a negro. I came into the world imbued with the will to reveal a meaning in things, my soul filled with a desire to be the origin of the world, and then I found that I was an object in the midst of other objects." That's at the beginning of a narration of his arrival in Paris and his first realization that he was being looked at in a different manner. The consideration in this small passage of human existence as the origin of the world, meaning as a condition for the constitution of what is simply given to us, the raw data of our perceptions, as a world, that is, as a meaningful totality, this idea is an essential tenet of the intellectual world of Fanon's formative years in France, of a world, as you know, which was fundamentally influenced by Husserl's phenomenology. And by the way, the translator here perhaps could have made it a bit clearer, should not have translated to reveal a meaning in things, because in French it's faire lever un sens aux choses, not so much to reveal a meaning that was already there, but to be engaged in the action of producing this meaning out of things. Talking of mistakes in translations, the worst one really is in the translation of L'expérience vécue du noir, an important chapter in Peau noire, masque blanc, as the fact of blackness. Well, what it means is the lived experience of blackness, because precisely it's not a fact, it is an experience. And the question is, how is it constructed, both from outside and from inside, in relationship to each other? The whole book, in fact, is aimed at showing that blackness is not a fact, but a web of experiences. So what does it all mean? What is this inner loss that is produced suddenly, in one instant, by the racist gaze? To understand it, I need to go a bit further and to say a few things about this intellectual background of Fanon's thought. Fanon encountered phenomenology, as I said, first through Merleau-Ponty, and the French phenomenological tradition considered the incarnation or the embodiment of thought here and now as structural to thought under the name of existence, precisely, existence. No mind exists independently of a particular situation in the world. There cannot be a divine point of view on the world as a totality from the outside. All perception takes place, again, says Merleau-Ponty, against a horizon, a background which itself can only be explored again against another background. In other words, all thought is situated by its incarnation. That's Merleau-Ponty, but Sartre, of course, who published for the first time Fanon in Les Temps Modernes, the journal that he created with Simone de Beauvoir and Merleau-Ponty, which still exists today. So Sartre influenced Fanon a lot. Fanon admired him. There is a very famous testimony by Simone de Beauvoir in her memoirs about Fanon's desire to meet Sartre, which she organized. But I found in his correspondence a letter addressed to Maspero, his publisher, saying, please tell him, Sartre, that each time I sit at my table, I think of him, he who writes things that are so important for our future. That was asking for Sartre to write the preface for his final book. And for this French phenomenological tradition, Merleau-Ponty, Sartre and others, before the concept of abstract thought can grasp it, the world is constructed first in space as a synthesis of perspectives or projections from a point of view situated in space, from a body. And then also it is constructed in time as a synthesis of a multiplicity of projects that are possible for a given subject in a given historical situation. So the world is nothing else than the synthesis of all these perspectives in space and in time. And you'll find a number of quotes by Merleau-Ponty, which I've reproduced here. I'll just read briefly one, number four. Our own body is not only an object in the world under the gaze of a separate mind. It shifts towards the position of the subject. It is our viewpoint on the world, the place where our mind becomes vested in a specific physical and historical situation. It is through the positioning of our body that we take possession of exterior space. At any given moment, a corporal or postural schema, that's a really important notion of the time, schema corporel, corporal schema, it's a crucial notion, gives us, at any moment, a corporal schema gives us a practical and implicit global notion of the relationship between our body and things, and as it were, its location in relation to them. An array of possible movements or mobilizing projects extends from us onto our surroundings. Our body does not occupy space as things do. It inhabits space or haunts it. So, for instance, when you entered this room, you knew that the door would not open into a different universe, that the ground would be solid and not liquid or fiery, that if you pulled the door, it would have the reverse effect to pushing it, which would not be the case if you were pulling a cart with a rope. Children have to learn that. And an infinity of other properties of your world. And yet, none of these ideas was present to your consciousness at any given moment. And probably they were not present, they've never been present to your consciousness until now. They were and are, in some sense, inscribed in your body, or more precisely in your brain, as special forms and limits of the patterns of action of your body. Or having a body is like drawing constantly, in real time, maps of the world in parallel with plans of possible action, coordinated maps and plans, which in the vocabulary of the psychology of the time were called sensory motor schemes or corporeal schemas, precisely. And these are only the first elements of a whole organization, pyramidal in a way, of your world and your body, and I assume that social anthropologists would study the upper layers of the structuring, the co-structuring in a way of the body and its environment. I can only allude here to the question of the nature of the process by which a consciousness constitutes objects as separate entities and the world as a totality of objects themselves constituted in this way. But it's enough to stress that Merleau-Ponty's position is not the postulation of a transcendental consciousness. Sartre had already tried to destroy this point of view in Husserl's philosophy. But what Merleau-Ponty says is, or focuses on, is rather the idea that the body itself, through the dialectic of its interaction with the world, gives sense to data in the given that surrounds the body. And you will find all that in La Structure du Comportement, The Structure of Behavior, which Merleau-Ponty published in 1942. And which is really still a very significant volume, recently republished by Routledge. Now, Fanon, training to be a psychiatrist, had read that, of course, closely. And until his death, Merleau-Ponty referred to the notion of corporeal schema, which had been developed, in fact, by a French psychiatrist called Jean Lhermitte in 1939, in a book called The Image of Our Body. And this notion is so essential to Fanon that he, too, constantly referred to it in each of his books, using it, corporal schema, as a sort of obvious notion. And he used it, for instance, to describe clinically the psychopathology of the lived experience of the Negro, he says, but also to reflect in a completely different context, in a political analysis, on the sociological transformations that are brought about, that were brought about by the Algerian War, on women's perceptions of their bodies through the perpetually renewed question of the veil. I'll say a bit more about the veil. But which he studied as a psychiatrist in the consciousness of the bearers of the veil, or those who had given up on it, for instance, in their dreams. There are texts by Fanon on dreams of women who had to remove the veil. The reason is that what racism does is precisely to destroy the corporal schema, not just because it institutes barriers to contain the body, slavery, of course, and all its material and institutional impediments or apparatus, or in other contexts, past laws, segregated areas, ghettos, etc. These limit the physical body as a thing, but not the corporal schema. In a jail, one could always draw plans for an escape. But racism goes further. As in some psychopathologies that were studied at the time, it destroys the corporal schema from the inside. It adds to the external economic, political exploitation, another dimension, a deeper alienation. And that's what Fanon really wants to study. And to continue on that, have a look at quote number 6. It continues, the perception of the gaze, of the racist gaze by the object of this gaze. Look, a Negro, says someone. It was an external stimulus that flicked over me as I passed by. I half smiled. Look, a Negro, it was true, it amused me. Look, a Negro, the circle was slowly drawing tighter. I made no secret of my amusement. Mummy, see the Negro, I'm scared. Scared. Now they were beginning to be scared of me. I made up my mind to laugh myself to tears, but laughter, for me, had become impossible. I could no longer laugh because I already knew that there were legends, stories, history, and above all, historicity, which I had learnt about from Jaspers. Then, assailed at various points, the corporal schema crumbled, its place taken by a racial epidermal schema. In the train, it was no longer a question of being aware of my body in the third person, as in Merleau-Ponty, but in a triple person. In the train, I was always given not one, but two or three places. It's really a beautiful description of this. Put yourself in this situation. Here is the scandal for Fanon, the true risk to the body. Under a particular gaze, it can become a thing within the world, and suddenly is abolished what was proper to the human body, its interrogative stance, this essential freedom or creative play in the relationship to the world. The word, the expression creative play, I should develop all that. Sartre has written a lot on that, Fanon a bit also, in particular in relationship to psychopedagogy and the pedagogy of development in children. Racism is the thorough destruction of the interrogative body that phenomenology had revealed and which is suddenly replaced by a thing. The opacity essential to the body of the other, the alter ego, what is called in Merleau-Ponty autrui, the other myself, whom I perceive as another self, and therefore as opaque to me as I would be to him or her. So the opacity which is essential to the body of the alter ego, as the absolutely unpredictable seat, says Merleau-Ponty, of possible actions and words, this opacity has vanished because the racist gaze sees in this body and this face just a thing, obvious, blatant, a surface without depth. And also, importantly, because this gaze has been interiorized by its object. Fanon found this idea of an interiorization of the gaze in Sartre's book, famous book on antisemitism, which for him was a masterpiece. He always refers to this, to the book that Fanon wrote after the war, on how you could not understand antisemitism if you didn't also see the effect that the antisemitic gaze had upon the object of the gaze. Racism, as analyzed by Sartre, is a system based not only, therefore, on the racist gaze, but also on the interiorization of this gaze by its objects, who always adopts it when he or she encounters it. And this adoption can take several forms, so this interiorization of the gaze of the racist, either in the form of a self-hatred, or the opposite, in the form of the affirmation of a difference, of an identity. So therefore, either in the form of a servile attitude or in the form, in the case of the blacks, of what was called in France at the time negritude, the claim for a black identity. Sartre has written famously a text called Black Orpheus about the book by Senghor, where Senghor gathered a number of black poets and where for the first time the notion of negritude was really emphasized in France. And Fanon also refers to Sartre's preface. What is left of the body in the racist system and on the experience that the object of this system has is a surface, a skin. For instance, number 7, Fanon says, on that day, disorientated, unable to be beyond myself, together with the other, the white man, who unmercifully imprisoned me through his gaze, I took myself far away from my own presence to the world, far indeed, and made myself an object. What else could it be for me but a skinning, an excision, a hemorrhage that spattered my whole body with black blood? The body, which is perceived as that of the nègre, the Negro, has been replaced by a black skin. Yeah. So, I've spoken of phenomenology, and you can see the influence. You need to read Fanon, of course, in great detail. You'll find it everywhere. It's really important for his thought. But I should also mention briefly the influence of psychoanalysis, because he refers to it in his reflection on the body.
Through training, of course, to become a psychiatrist, Fanon became interested in psychoanalysis, and in particular he referred several times to Lacan's theory of the mirror stage, which at that time was not very well known, and he was not particularly interested in anything else in Lacan, but this he focused on, because of course it was really important for his conception of the self in its relationship to the image that it has of its own body. He only refers to Lacan and to psychoanalysis to show, by contrast, how the normal, or at least the usual ways in which the self constitutes itself, are transformed or deformed or destroyed within the colonial context. So the mirror stage, as you probably know, shows how young human beings differ from, say, baby chimpanzees, says Lacan, when they learn to recognize themselves in the mirror. This self, which is recognized, of course, is not there as a thing. What there is, which the animal, the chimpanzee, will see equally well as the baby human, is the mass of physical singularities and movements that are to be seen, and which are no different from the rest of the world. But when the child is shown his own image by his mother, and when this image is related through language to his name or to a name, and differentiated from her image and from her name, and he builds or she builds a consciousness of herself as other than the mother and the surrounding world, and in a way, this consciousness covers the perception of the body with a filter or a veil, the image of an identity, a mask or a persona, which will be always recognized, of course, in the mirror. You will always recognize your own face unless you see yourself, for instance, in a double mirror reflection and an unexpected angle, or on a photograph from an angle that you would never see in a mirror, but otherwise you always see this mask there. And from that very moment, this mask, the persona, makes the self enter the realm of the symbolic, of signs, which denote concepts, abstractions, and never form images of concrete singularities. So that's finished. What you see from now on is a mask. This is all very well, and that's the self. This is, or at least a fundamental component of it. This is all very well in a normal context, but Fanon states that the reverse process occurs when the colonized has the first of the many continuous experiences of his or her physical alterity. The image of the self fragments, crumbles, and is replaced by unspecified physical singularities. It then sees itself not as a being at a distance, constitutive of a world that it faces, but rather as a thing, so to speak, completely adherent to its physical singularities. There are many texts by Fanon on that. They're more of a literary nature. I've just reproduced one. It's number 10. I come slowly to the world, accustomed now to seek no longer for a sudden unveiling, or springing out of the world, in fact, in the original. I progress by crawling, and already I am being dissected under the white gaze, the only real gaze. I am fixed. I slip into corners, and my long antennae pick up the catchphrases strewn over the surface of things. The Negro's teeth are white, the Negro's feet are big, the Negro's barrel chest. I slip into corners, I remain silent, I strive for anonymity, for invisibility. So in the skin there is history, an inheritance suddenly bearing so heavily that only crawling like an insect is available to a body which is now flattened and fragmented into the anonymous classifications of a clinical gaze. You may think, when you think of the history of social anthropology, of what it must have been like to be submitted to the gaze of a social anthropologist, at least at the beginning of social anthropology. That's a useful description of it, I would think, for social anthropologists. Some people want to do that. The Cartesian cogito, as the simple possibility of a separation of the self from its physical incarnation, of course, is forever impossible in such a condition. These Kafkaesque descriptions of a becoming animal, which is not this becoming animal, to use the expression of Deleuze, in this case, is not at all experienced as a process of liberation, but rather as a trap, an alienation. It's like becoming a butterfly on a plank. A simultaneous loss of the self and of the world. This echo, also another intellectual thread that I have briefly mentioned, the study of the psychopathology of the image of the body, but I stress that because it was an important theme of the psychiatry of the period when Fanon studied, and it is now again becoming a fashionable object of study in psychiatry. So, for instance, Lhermitte, who had invented the concept of schéma corporel, defined it as a function of integration of sensations and perceptions, which could be sometimes disturbed. And for instance, he studied asomatognosia, where people see themselves in mirrors but cannot recognize themselves. Now, some really interesting descriptions by early descriptions of this condition by Lhermitte, which of course Fanon was also very aware of. The veil of the self, which had been stretched via language, so to speak, over the immediate sensations and perceptions of the body, had dissolved for these people. The body was now perceived as an object or fragments of objects within the world, what Lacan calls the real, rather than a project of action, a bit as if in this room you perceive not tables, chairs and persons, but masses of woodiness and fleshiness. Try to do that. A sort of schizophrenic transformation, which perhaps the paintings of Bacon would try to reflect. Deleuze has written some nice things on Bacon precisely from this perspective. Okay, so we can now, I hope, understand the meaning of Fanon's prayer and of the risk that his body faces constantly, or rather that this character that he studies in the first person throughout this work, which is an ambiguous work, constantly in the third and the first person, because it's a psychiatric study of the consciousness, and he says from the very beginning that it can only be done paradoxically in the first person because of this incarnation of this consciousness, of course, in this very specific historical and geographical situation that he happened to be born in. I hope that now you can start to understand the meaning of Fanon's prayer and of the risk that his body or this body faces constantly. And to conclude, I just want to point to examples of links that he saw and constantly wove in all his other books between this very specific and psychopathological analysis of the colonized, on the one hand, and the ethical necessity of an anti-colonial struggle, on the other hand, within some very specific geographical and historical situations. And then you can pursue these links yourself when you read the rest of his other books. But just to give you a few examples. For instance, the first chapter of his second book, called Sociologie d'une Révolution, Sociology of a Revolution. In fact, it was initially called the Year 5 of the Algerian Revolution, but the title was removed. I found the beautiful letter by Maspero, his publisher, saying to Fanon, saying... you will notice that I've removed the original title from the cover. It is now inside only. That should give us 48 hours before the police raids the warehouse. It shows the difficulty at the time during the Algerian War to publish something like that. So Sociology of a Revolution was more palatable. But in fact, it's Year 5 of the Algerian Revolution. And it's the first chapter is called L'Algérie se dévoile, Algeria unveils itself. And it's a study of the perception within the colonial context of the body of Algerian women and the impact that this perception has upon their corporeal schema of these women. So how the perception of their body by themselves, by others, by the colonizers, has on their corporeal schema. And Fanon does a sort of, as often, dialectical sequence. And he says that within the pre-colonial culture, even the pre-anthropological times, before the 19th century, the veil, he says, is simply a traditional piece of clothing, like the fez, little pointed hat, the djellaba, the babouche, the slippers, etc. But suddenly, under the colonial gaze, it becomes solidified as a symbol, an essential feature of the culture which needs to be eradicated. And under the pretext of liberation, because it has been solidified by the gaze of those who came from outside, it must be now removed. And the French army organized, you can still see some of these films reproduced on YouTube, ceremonies of unveiling. So it's a very paradoxical thing when you have the soldiers on the one hand and all these women removing their veils in order to celebrate their newfound liberation. So it's fairly astonishing demonstrations in the 50s. He says, every new Algerian woman unveiled announced to the occupier an Algerian society whose systems of defense were in the process of dislocation, open and breached. Of course, he does not take seriously the claims of liberation and civilizing influence because I think largely of his experience at the end of the Second World War. These experiences are often described, by the way, in bodily terms, like, for instance, who's going to dance with the soldiers from the Caribbean? There were problems, etc., during the liberation, etc. So he does not take those claims of liberation or civilization seriously. They are, for him, just parts of a strategy of power. He thinks of these in terms of Sartre already, in particular, the critic of dialectical reason, which he had read just after its publication and considered an extraordinary text. In fact, it was a sort of philosophy of anti-colonial struggle when you read it in retrospect now. But he anticipates on Foucault on that. But this, secondly, produces a reaction, and the veil. So the veil is ossified by the occupier who wants to remove it. And this, in the name of liberation, this produces a reaction, and then the veil suddenly becomes significant and alive, while before it had been a sort of just anodyne piece of clothing. And he says, number 12, in the face of the violence of the occupier, the colonized finds himself defining a principled position with respect to a formerly inert element of the native cultural configuration. And he notes a similarity between that and what happens in African and mostly Caribbean cultures, where he says the white creates the Negro, but it's the Negro who creates negritude, in retrospect, who claims a great black identity and then refers to the great kingdoms of Zimbabwe, etc., in order to find again some sort of identity, which Fanon is very suspicious of. He says it's not these claims of great ancestry which is going to change the situation of the Senegalese dockers in Marseille. But nevertheless, this negritude movement will have played a significant role and is understandable in those terms. So it's the same thing that happens for him with the revendication, the claiming of the veil. But then third stage, finally, when the veil is removed by colonized women themselves, he says, taking part in a struggle, for instance, in order to infiltrate the colonizer's society, their former corporal schema is destroyed, but now they have to invent a new one, and the structure of the traditional society is going to be transformed. That's what he says, number 13. One must have heard the confessions of Algerian women or have analyzed the dream content of certain recently unveiled women to appreciate the importance of the veil for the woman's experience of her body. Without the veil, she has an impression of her body being cut up into bits, put adrift. The limbs seem to lengthen indefinitely. A sense of incompleteness experienced with great intensity. These are notes, case notes, in fact, that we have, that he has pretty much recopied into his text. The anxious feeling that something is unfinished, a frightful sensation of disintegrating. The absence of the veil distorts the Algerian woman's corporal schema. Again, the corporal schema. She quickly has to invent new dimensions for her body, new means of muscular control. She has to create for herself an attitude of unveiled woman outside. The Algerian woman who walks stark naked into the European city relearns her body, reestablishes it in a totally revolutionary fashion. This new dialectic of the body and of the world is primary in the case of women. So the true liberation is not in being given a freedom from the outside, but in constructing it through the body. And he added in a footnote, famous footnote, engaged in the struggle, the husband or the father discovers new perspectives on the relationship between the sexes. The male militant discovers the female militant, and jointly they create new dimensions in Nigerian society. Slightly propagandist tone, of course. No doubt he would have been dismayed to see post-colonial societies moving back against their own history and returning again to the veil as a cultural or religious symbol, adopting precisely the point of view that he described as that of the former colonizer, an objectifying one. And several testimonies show that he was aware quite early on of the possibility that the national fight might be transformed into a traditionalist one, and the revolutionary stance being then replaced by a forced obedience to transcendent, that is, in his vocabulary, ossified values. Hence his criticism of negritude, and probably why he moved away from Algeria to really concentrate on Pan-Africanism at the end of his life. And a second example, it's in the third book, Pour la Révolution Africaine, precisely, this, his book on Pan-Africanism. It's torture. His constant attention to the relationship between colonialism and a power exerted through the body explains Fanon's ambivalent attitude towards the liberal left in France, which at the beginning mostly fought against torture in Algeria, but not at all for independence. There was a very strong movement of support for the Algerians in France from 1955-56, but it was largely born out of the horror at the torturing that the army was engaged in on a large scale. By 1960 only, independence became the main theme. So initially it was an ethical issue. It's only later that it became a political issue for the French left. He refused to see torture as an aberration, and for him, it's in fact implied in the colonial gaze upon the body of the other. This is what he says, number 15. In reality, the attitude of the French troops in Algeria fits into a pattern of police domination, of systematic racism, of dehumanization rationally pursued. Torture is inherent in the whole colonialist configuration. Again, deep-seated skepticism vis-à-vis humanist values. Torture cannot be simply separated from exploitation and alienation, and he even wrote a whole section called Torture, a Fundamental Necessity of the Colonial World, where he says, torture in Algeria is not an accident or an error or a fault. Colonialism cannot be understood without the possibility of torturing, of violating, or of massacring. Torture is a modality of the occupant-occupied relationship. And finally, a final example, in his last book, Les Damnés de la Terre, The Wretched of the Earth, when Fanon analyzes the reciprocal links between national culture and liberation struggle, his initial understanding of the body as the seat of an interrogative stance towards the world again comes back and underlies his thought. And this is what he says, number 17, in a it's adapted from a text of a famous lecture he gave. In the colonial situation, dynamism is replaced fairly quickly by a substantification of the attitudes. Every effort is made to bring the colonized person to admit the inferiority of his culture, which has been transformed into instinctive patterns of behavior, to recognize the unreality of his nation, and in the last extreme, the confused and imperfect character of his own biological structure. By the time a century or two of exploitation has passed, there comes about a veritable, true emaciation of the stock of natural culture. It becomes a set of automatic habits, some traditions of dress, and a few broken down institutions. Little movement can be discerned in such remnants of culture. There is no real creativity and no overflowing life. While when the revolution starts, he says, number 18, the contact of the people with the new movement, the new epic, he says, gives rise to a new rhythm of life and to forgotten muscular tensions and develops the imagination. And you will find countless other examples, in particular in his psychiatric professional texts, which are unpublished yet, but I hope there are all sorts of issues with the inheritors of the right. That's why all these texts haven't yet been produced, but I hope we'll be able to produce these, at least these psychiatric notes, which are really interesting because they contain all sorts of instructions to the nurses as to how to deal with the patients, especially in Blida, where the large psychiatric hospital was in Algeria, which was split into two wings, one for the indigenous population, the other one for the whites, and where he had to develop different therapies, even though initially he didn't want to. So he gives them special instructions, and they refer to different modes of approaching, looking at the patient. So all this is quite interesting. So to summarize, human thought does not face reality as God faces the world. It is within it and develops as it moves within it. Fanonian freedom presupposes the consciousness of the here and now of all thought, of its incarnation, and its essential temporality in the endless construction of a world. That's the only foundation for an ethics in his time. Seeing the body of another human being is not seeing a thing. It is rather seeing the evidence of another perspective in the making, a necessary opacity, therefore, for the observer. And keeping that in mind, I think, is if there's one lesson for social anthropologists, that would be that one from Fanon. Making sure that one is always conscious of the opacity of the other. There is, however, a historical geographical situation which endangers the body taken in this sense, colonialism, and its correlate, racism. Fanon was born and raised in the Caribbean, where white masks as denigration of black skin are so common. Everybody thinks, all think that they are more white than the other. And these black masks that he denounced, these white masks that he denounced, in fact, hide a deeper, sinister reality, a consciousness of the skin so acute that it hides or erases the essential and irreducible opacity of the human body as the origin of all assignations of meaning. An issue which is probably, in fact, quite common in most postcolonial societies, but this you would know better than me. Whatever the case, when, because of the historical circumstances that threw him into the wider world, coming from a somewhat farcical situation in the Caribbean to Europe and then going to Africa, where he realized what the situation was, and when he could reflect on his gaze, he also concluded that freedom could not be given or received, and that whether he liked it or not, it had to come through the physical experience that could only institute it. And that's how I think one can understand his writings on violence, which were the object of a lot of discussion. And it's important to know that he was very aware of the dangers of such processes, which has been a bit forgotten. But nevertheless, I think that's the crux of his thought. Thank you.
When we're being kicked out, but I think we do have a few minutes at least for questions and comments.
A few interrogative bodies.
In fact, like, one thing that I was particularly interested in, and I'm a bit confused because I think the English, the way his works were published in English are slightly different. It seems like studies of or in a dying colonialism is in fact taking together both his second book and his last book, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, in this work he also refers especially to the veil as a means through which the resistance can also be waged against the French. So I remember he's got passages in which he says the body in fact, because I mean the attitudes towards the veil were shifting at that time, so that the body in fact which is covered under a veil can also be used to hide weapons and guns, he says at some point, thereby of course creating this sort of tension between those that are occupied and subjected and, you know, never really knowing whether they might not potentially have something underneath their veils, which in the Battle of Algiers is sort of, you know, exactly...
Yeah. If you watch the recent most recent edition of the Battle of Algiers, Ponte Corvo is interviewed, and he says that there's a famous scene where you see fathers and brothers being a bit uneasy about sending their daughters and wives unveiled into the city after bombs had exploded and the veil. So now they had to go without the veils. And he says that this scene was the depiction of their relationships in these scenes were inspired by his reading of this text by Fanon. In fact, yeah. So it had an influence.
I mean, the question there that posed itself for me was, in fact, did he only think of bodies as potentially being deconstructed, or was there a way in which one therefore could also, you know, positively use one's body rather than it just being sort of a
Yeah, he's dancing. He was a great dancer, apparently, but Fanon didn't write. He dictated while walking. And there are plenty of testimonies on the sort of his bodily presence when he entered the room. It was visible.
He inherited from Merleau-Ponty this idea that the source of all value is in fact a certain positioning of the body within the world. Mm. And he has to be read through Merleau-Ponty, I think, in that way.
So, yeah. But what he wrote about was when this possibility was denied. Mm. And he especially was interested in how it was denied from the inside, so to speak. Sort of crumbling of his consciousness. But because he was a psychiatrist.
More questions?
Just in time.
I don't think he's going to kick us out yet. Okay. Well, in that sense, perhaps, because there are a couple of things that I just find striking as well, in particular because some of the works that he wrote were based exactly on his experiences as a practicing psychiatrist. So he wasn't just sort of writing about the experiences from sort of taking these people back into a particular office where he treated them, but he was, I just wonder whether, you mentioned that there are some notes that one could potentially have access to, but to what extent, one can... To what extent he is, in therefore, of a sort, an ethnographer who's there.
That's one thing I could say a few more things about. This first book, Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, he tried to submit it as his PhD in psychiatry, and it was refused on the ground that in it he didn't respect the necessary distance between the self and the other, the subject and the object, etc. Even though he writes, but. Part of it was rewritten afterwards, that he could not have done otherwise. And in order to explore this consciousness, he had to speak in the first person. And it's from almost a literary point of view, it's an extraordinary text because it's a bit like the Phenomenology of the Spirit by Hegel. It's how the exploration of an individual's consciousness in a way summarizes the experience of a very long historical process. So that's why he calls it the lived experience of the Negro, the crucial chapter in the book. So yeah, it could be quite useful, a useful read for social anthropologists, because of course that's an issue that is constantly raised.
Then, following from that, what I do find interesting is that you said one has to dissociate his sort of earlier interest as a practicing doctor from his later political writings.
But no, one shouldn't. Sorry,
one shouldn't. Yeah, exactly. That sort of, because it becomes obviously interesting if he has to treat the soldiers as well as those affected by the soldiers. So he's. You said he was slightly reluctant, in fact, to devise ways of dealing with the soldiers, but he did nonetheless. He was there treating them, in fact, although he was fighting them at the same time, in a way.
Yeah. For a short period of time, because his position became quite quickly untenable, for the last 6 months of his position in the psychiatric asylum in Blida, he
treated everyone. In fact, he was very interested. By the way, it's not only the soldiers who tortured, but also the FLN, because the situation in Algeria is, and that's not finished. So he was interested in both dimensions of it. The effect it had also on the torturer and what sort of gaze the torturer had. And he describes the case studies of nightmares of people who have tortured, etc. Complex also, more complex things about people whose spouses have been tortured or violated or raped, etc. So that again is very important for him. And he studied that quite at length. Now, what I meant when I said one should not separate the two, it's simply a sort of criticism of recent Fanon criticism studies or scholarship, where his anti-colonial work has been separated from the more psychiatric or psychophenomenological work, either because early on, in the 60s and 70s, he was only studied for his anti-colonial work. All of the texts that were published then were mostly The Wretched of the Earth and For the African Revolution. Or because in the 80s, with the development of postmodernism, etc., then suddenly nobody wanted to hear about his historical, political, crucial involvement. I mean, really, he was very significant. He was everywhere at all the Pan-Africanist Congresses, and he was a very influential character. The FLN nominated him as their ambassador for Africa, so he did really play a role. But this, of course, was obliterated because people then only became interested in his reflections on métissage, mixed races, or interiorization of the duality of belonging, in a way. Even though what he said was not at all what then became fashionable, which is that métissage is a model for the rest of the world and that everybody is métissé, etc., he certainly didn't want to think in those terms either. In both cases, you're misunderstanding him if you separate those two dimensions. What's interesting is how the political, national, and Pan-Africanist struggle is rooted in his analysis of the constitution of the self through its body, which in turn can only be understood through his own personal experience in Martinique and going to France, etc., in such extraordinary historical circumstances.
So he's also saying that, for example, his own writing would not have been possible without him actually having had those particular experiences.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's he says it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great example of situatedness in the world. By the way, when he met Sartre, Lanzmann, I interviewed Claude Lanzmann, who was then the secretary of Sartre, at length, and I published this interview in a new form. But anyway, Lanzmann told me that it's the first time he saw Sartre not write anything for 3 days. So in July 1961, he was already very ill, Fanon, etc., managed to get to Rome, and that was difficult. He had been subjected to two or three assassination attempts, one certainly by the French army, but most certainly one by the FLN itself, because he was friendly with people who were not any longer well seen within the National Liberation Front in Algeria. So he managed to get to Rome, where Sartre every year spent his vacations with Simone de Beauvoir. And Simone de Beauvoir says for 3 days Sartre just listened to him. They were completely fascinated. And not only Sartre not writing anything, but also listening to someone for so long, he couldn't listen to her. So that was quite something. And Lanzmann said they were amazed. Sartre was really fascinated. And the text that he wrote afterwards is a bit ambiguous, the preface to Les Derniers de la Terre, because he celebrated aspects that perhaps Fanon would have wanted celebrated. But it shows how it impressed Sartre, and it reformed his view of the anti-colonial struggle. So his own experience and his own existence for Sartre was absolutely linked to his to what he could produce, and that was, for him, a great example of precisely what Sartre had theorized. But there's no thought without an incarnation or situatedness.
I think we might possibly give them some time to come in.